Tell the truth and shame the devil.
What's wrong with this thing? What's wrong with this thing? I think it's busted.
Busted. Busted mouth. Busted mouth.
What's good, ladies, gentlemen, those beyond the binary, poets, perverts, explorers of all kinds, nuts, butts, and coconuts. Welcome to Bust a Mouth, usually every Monday on Q4 Radio from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m., but currently working from home because we're all gonna die. It's a show about rock and roll, sticking it to the man, your big stupid feeling, streaming around the world for the time being, everywhere you get your podcasts, you know, all the places. I'm J.W. Basilo, your host is always. Hi, how are you? I hope whatever you're doing, you are staying safe and relatively calm. A vaccine is on its way, people. It's a Thursday, because we're Thursdays now, but a vaccine is on its way. As of today, the vaccine goes into science court, which I didn't know was a real thing, but just a thing that we did in fifth grade. But ha, 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 now it's real. And I'm excited about it. I'm very curious as to what a science court is. I think it's pretty cool. Anyway, couple quick announcements besides, of course, stay the fuck home and wear a mask. Let's see. Shame the Devil Media continues to rage on. Foxtrot, which is a podcast of human geography with Nick Fox, and Twitchy Traveler with Tim Stafford are both making some slower strides than we expected, but will drop in the new year. And the literary side of Shame the Devil will be something that we're going to be tackling in the new year as well. So these essays will finally have a home. We'll be taking submissions, et cetera, et cetera. I envision it as less of a journal or a lit mag and more of a place to just kind of hang up cool shit. A national coffeehouse gallery, I guess, kind of thing, maybe, hopefully. But hopefully with some regular contributors and even some regular columns. More info on that to come. I am a little overwhelmed with the world, but I'm working on it. We continue to make slow progress, and slow progress is better than no progress. Also, Wokefield, speaking of not slow progress, Wokefield, the Sweet Valley High podcast that I produce on behalf of Shame the Devil, it just reached 1,000 downloads over the weekend. I'm really digging that show. And it's only a few episodes old, but it's already gaining some really good ground, and people are excited about it, and I'm digging the show. I really am, and I'm proud of its success. If you haven't checked it out yet, please do. You don't even have to be a fan of the books. It's some silliness with a message slipped in there between the jokes. Not dissimilar from this show, but way funnier. It's also created and hosted by women, and it's funny. Can you believe it? Women. Funny. I know. Huh. I'm so over that debate. I don't have an essay this week, but I am bringing you a great interview with an old friend. When I first came into the slam and national poetry scene over 15 years ago, my guest, Billy Tuggle, was one of the first people to really welcome me. He's been a teammate and a mentor and a friend, and I'm finding it more and more cathartic right now to connect with folks, especially those who were mainstays in my world for so long, a world that I all but acrimoniously abandoned a few years ago. And I don't know. I mean, now I'm just now finding the peace to address it again, and I'm feeling good about that. And Billy is a great guy and an important figure in Chicago's literary and oral tradition, and he's also just a great dude to talk music with. I like this conversation. I hope you do too. It's obviously still in the pantheon of remote Zoom interviews, but we were able to pull out some serviceable audio. It was really good to catch up with Billy. I think you'll dig it. Check it out. We'll see you next week. I'm with my friend here, my friend Billy Tuggle, former teammate, long-standing haiku deathmatch national champion. I think this is true. You've represented Chicago at the National Poetry Slam more than any other poet. Is that correct?
Yes.
The Karm Aquarius himself. It's good to see you, Billy Tuggle.
It's good to see you. It's good to be seen. It's a little fishy and otherwise.
It's wild out here, and all it took was a podcast and some Zoom, and I'm actually able to talk to my friends for the first time in like a year, which is great. What are you working on right now?
Other than being a teaching artist that I have managed to flip, learning about all of this writing and poetry and good stuff for the last 20 years, I managed to flip into being a teaching artist. And at the grade school level, as an independent contractor in Chicago Public Schools, specifically working on just remaining creative, but in that realm directly, trying to put together a manuscript, a full collection of stuff that has not been released. Things you might have heard here and there over the last few years, but things I haven't put out into the universe. I've I've done performance poetry for so long that they always say when you, and I didn't come as an academic, I came as a performer. So it's the equivalent of always having, you know, a mixtape or an EP or a CD. I've done performance poetry for so long. I've had one book that was not self-published, and I've had a lot of success with submission and publishing lately. So it's time to get off of the self-publishing train and put my worth back out there. So I'm also taking my time to put the better stuff out.
Right on.
But just trying to get that manuscript finished.
Cool. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to ask you the question that I ask everybody, and I'm very excited about your answer. First record you ever remember buying with your own money?
I can tell you specifically which album it was, because I was you know, a 70s baby, so I was into the 45s, and I got quite a few 45s before the first album. But the first album I got, I think I was 8 years old, and it was the Jackson's Destiny.
Right on.
Yeah, right on. That was the Blame It on the Boogie. That was that album.
Did you like save up your allowance and to ask your mom to take you to the store and get it? How did it happen?
More or less, at 8 years old, didn't have a real allowance, but when you got decent grades, you get $5 or $10 from grandparents, and I have family in Detroit, so it was a road trip, mini family reunion for the weekend in Detroit. We stopped in a little shopping mall to eat breakfast at Big Boy on the way home. I was a music fan at eight.
Yep.
There was a record store. I got Destiny. Much before Off the Wall came out. So yeah, I was like all about it at that point.
I knew you would have an answer. I asked that question for everybody because I think it's a good place to start for a lot of folks, but a lot of people are just like, oh man, it must have been this, that, or the other. And it's usually like either they don't know or it's a super embarrassing story, but I knew that you would have a very dialed in specific, this is where I was. I knew the record I was buying when I bought it. So you started with that Jackson's record. Did it start taking off from there? Like, did it become a collection issue? Were you the guy who immediately started buying records all over the place?
More or less, again, because I was young and I wasn't even at that point. I wasn't getting an allowance until I was about 9 or 10. We got a cat when I was 9. So I was making money, you know, doing the cat stuff, shoveling the walkway and everything. This is during the suburban exile. So we had a big driveway to shovel.
Well,
around that time, I was already a big music fan. At 5, I went to my first concert. I went to see the Spinners. And I told my parents I wanted to see the Spinners.
Love it.
That same summer that Jackson's album came out was also the Parliament Funkadelic Funk Fest tour.
Mm-hmm.
That was almost my second concert. It sold out. It was at Soldier Field. I was already a music fan. So at that point, for holidays, I was asking for albums. That Christmas, if it wasn't that year, it was the next. One Nation Under a Groove had come out. The soundtrack to The Wiz had come out. Parliament, The Motor Booty Affair come out, and I had gotten all those albums as Christmas presents. The little bit of money I did start earning by the time I was 9 or 10, I was buying 45s and albums. I was already a music fan at that point. And at that age, I was starting to outgrow wanting to be an astronaut, but I wanted to be DJ on the radio, because that was back in the old days when you still played your own shit. You played what you wanted to play.
Yep.
They gave you 20 songs, and then you picked the other 20 songs. So I wanted to be a DJ at that point, and I was in, you know, music class and stuff like that in grade school. And I started to, maybe a vocalist or a musician. So at that point, I was pretty much a solid concrete fan of music. It was at that point, you just knew you just wanted, people put out whole albums and not just one song or two songs. So at 8, 9 years old, you know, that's the late 70s, early 80s. You already knew who the Jacksons were.
Yeah.
You know, discovering at that point Prince, Van Halen, whatever else was popular at the turn of the decade at that point.
Yeah, and I'm similar boat. You know, like my dad was I grew up on Motown. Like, that's what my dad was into. So when he was at work, you know, if I was home during the day or whatever, I was just going through all of his records and putting them on, and like being very careful not to scratch them. Even though I was like 5, 6 years old, you know, I'm putting that Jackson 5 record on. I'm putting that Four Tops Temptation album on, and that was just how I spent my days. So for me, really getting into music was something I was. Obviously, something that we both chased pretty hard. And I remember when, like, my first album, I've told this story 100 times, so I apologize for that, listeners. But my first album was, I bought a tape of Motley Crue's Dr. Feelgood, and I had to use my own money because my folks weren't paying for it. So I got like $1.25 a week in allowance or something like that. Like, you had to take the trash out, do all that stuff. So I like saved up my allowance so I could buy a Dr. Feelgood tape. And that was just
hilarious.
It's where
I love your parents. I've met and hung out with your parents. And they're funny. And what's funny is you and me, we're not quite 10 years apart, but I have a little brother who's 10 years younger than me. And his gateway to music was, because it was the, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, his gateway to music was me and MTV.
Right.
So it was either Vanilla Ice or A Tribe Called Quest.
Yep, yep. That makes sense. So you famously have a poem, Negro Amplophobia, Fear of a Black Rock. You've done it a bunch. We all, you know, I think that was my favorite poem of yours. I think it still is probably my favorite poem of yours. When was it that you discovered rock music? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Probably right around that same time I realized, not just stylistically, but also culturally, musical differences. And I'll tell you what it was, is like at that age, voracious radio listener, a Chicago kid. So WLS was like the station, mm-hmm. the loop to some extent, but for our house, because it leaned more towards pop and a little bit of multiple styles, WLS on AM and then FM radio, also black radio, particularly WJPC. But FM radio started to get big. So then came WBMX, which is not the current WBMX, which is now V103, but also WGCI. And you notice that the two stations played kind of different styles of music. But I also, at that point, was growing up in the South suburbs in a 50-50 integrated grade school, black and white. White kids didn't listen to all the same stuff the black kids did, unless it was Michael Jackson, Elton John, some disco stuff, but we all did not listen to the same stuff. But what that meant, and this was like going over kids' house after baseball practice and stuff, was I was discovering Foreigner, Van Halen, AC/DC, and guitars, and wondering like, why didn't black music have guitars like that? And all of a sudden Prince's music had a few more guitars. And then I discovered Jimi Hendrix. But my real fall into rock music, I guess it was kind of gradual, was by the time I had left the Burbs and went to high school. This was the mid 80s when metal was starting to gain like a little bit more prominence, and going to even though it was a predominantly black high school on the South Side, it was a magnet high school. So going to a school like Kenwood, you found kids that listened to Metallica. You found kids that listened to Megadeth and Black Sabbath and Guns N' Roses. So it wasn't all that unusual. And that was around the same time that culturally rock music was beginning to boomerang back. Bad Brains had been popular, but Fishbone was coming out, Living Color was coming out, and a few more bands after that. And Prince had reached his apex at that point. And so black kids were getting into Sly and the Family Stone and Hendrix. And we were listening to our parents' older Funkadelic albums. Like, I discovered Funkadelic at One Nation Under a Groove, as opposed to discovering Funkadelic at Maggot Brain, which I was a baby at that point. So if you are culturally astute, then you make the cultural connections. And so it's not all that wild and all that different. And this is also at the time where you had, you know, Tracy Chapman, Terrence Trent D'Arby and stuff like that. So it wasn't all that wildly different, but you recognize that you were not a part of the mainstream. The irony is that it takes you so long out of what you actually grew up with, like growing up with the Isley Brothers and stuff like that, to realize that it's something that you're not fully, fully a part of. And then for me, it was a little bit of an identity crisis, because I was a hip hop kid, but I was also a little bit of a rocker kid too. I was punk hop, basically, for a little while there.
So did you have separate, like, were your friends kind of separate? Like, did you have your rock friends and your hip hop friends, or did it all kind of bleed together?
I didn't really find a rocker scene as much as I found kind of a crossover integrated music scene in my late teens, early 20s. But because I couldn't hold a band together, I never got knee deep into the scene. And also in Chicago, there are definitely some unspoken cultural and racial lines. Like, even though my band was upstarts, we could barely get heard by, you know, the Thirsty Whale. We did get heard by the late, great Dave Medusa, and it didn't pull a gig, but we at least got listened to.
Sure.
But we also weren't ready and we weren't stable. And not being ready and stable kind of pushed me back towards graffiti and going to a lot of hip hop parties, but it also pushed me into my journals and open mics and where I found poetry. So while never finding a rock scene that I found stable and welcoming, that did not help me in music at all. It did make me go deeper into pursuing other avenues of art and other scenes too. Like I went to a bunch of stuff that I didn't participate in, but just because I like to hang out. But I also was that weird cat who was in the corner with a notebook too. If I wasn't dancing, or if I wasn't hanging out at the bar, or being friendly, and I am an introverted extrovert. I can hang with 500 people and be by myself, or I can be the life of the party. Sure. But if I was at the bar writing, then 3 years later you would go see me at poetry open mic, because I was not finding that rock scene that I was really a part of. I really felt comfortable that.
So, I mean, the music that we grow up with obviously shapes like who we are and the people that we become. And, you know, obviously, like, you get a lot of it. I've brought it up already. Like, I got it from my father. You talk about, you know, finding your parents' P-Funk records and stuff. So you've got a daughter, and Carmody's in second grade now. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's that like? Are you walking her through music? Are you kind of letting her discover stuff on her own? What's the story there?
I'm not going to lie and say that it's not 10-15% programming, but also where it starts is things like studies that have become just like a regular normal thing since we were babies, of, you know, talking to the womb, talking to the fetus and things like that. So the child has not only recognized my voice from the day she was born, but certain songs have also kind of resonated with her. So having said that, she's always been kind of a background fan of 60s, 70s, 80s music. But she's been a fan of music in general. She's had a little radio in her room ever since she was a baby, and she sleeps through the night with music on. But it's always been a variance of stations and a variance of styles. And I've never made her change from one or the other unless she finds the college station with the person after midnight or after 10 o'clock. We have to turn that off. But otherwise, it pretty much whatever is broadcast is fair game. It's kind of the way I was raised. It's kind of... You know, and I bring my kid to poetry slams and have since she was a baby, so you know how we get down. But what she listens to, and this is historical, is always going to boomerang back to the source material or the greater source. If it's something that's original and innovative, you're going to remember it, and it's going to be timeless, and that includes anything new that she hears. So I don't even really worry about it. There's newer stuff that I just kind of cringe and roll my eyes at, but even that, you know, she just turned 8. Being a parent for 8 years, that's never bothered me. I've been a career uncle for 30 years.
Right.
So you can't surprise me with anything. I've been a big brother. I've been a career uncle for, like, you know, for 30 years and a mentor. So I've gone from being the bad influence and turning kids on to things that are completely, like, not great or inappropriate, to having to filter it myself. And 9 times out of 10, you just remember from your own childhood or from your little brother or from your nephew that's 25 or 30 years old that they didn't turn out to be a serial killer, you know. So your child will be fine.
What kind of stuff does she dig that that makes you roll your eyes?
JoJo Siwa.
Oh, I just learned about JoJo Siwa. That's music?
Yeah, she's kind of like, I don't know what her origins are. I don't know if she was a Disney kid, but she's super popular. 3 or 4 hit songs. But the other thing that I recognize immediately is that this kid was like 13, 14, 15 years old. And so now she's hitting that mature stage of teenage years where the teeny bopper stuff is going to mature a little bit.
Right.
So we'll see how she comes and comes differently. I only say JoJo Siwa because that's one of the ones that she names by name. I'll tell you one, and he's a big giant pop culture figure. Carmody loves Bruno Mars.
Okay.
So until the time that Carmody was born, I found Bruno Mars utterly irritating, except for 2 or 3 songs, which is kind of how it works. That's how I know you're clever and talented, is when everything you do bugs me except for that 1 or 2 songs. I'm like, oh, okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You're capable. I'm going to be annoyed by you for the next 20 years or longer, but it's fine. So now all of a sudden I have a kid who hears all this super catchy stuff that he writes, even though some of it's vaguely inappropriate for her age, but it reminds me of, you know, liking Prince and Parliament Funkadelic when I'm 5, 6, 7 years old. So it is what it is. But the stuff is also clever enough to where I can tolerate it. Any big radio hit over the last 8 years, Happy by Pharrell.
Sure.
Pretty much anything. If it was big on the radio over the last 8 years, you know, she likes it and dances to it. If it's a TikTok hit, you know, Candy, the wife, she's just very pop susceptible. But also, I have a lot of things I shut out for a long time because, again, I worked in a record store for 13 and a half years.
Right,
so
right.
You learn to filter certain things out. But as much as she likes all the big pop hits, she's fallen into a big Michael Jackson thing lately. I think her music teacher is a big Michael Jackson fan. So we've had a big Michael Jackson phase. She knows Daddy was a huge Prince fan. So ever since, like, even before Prince died, Prince has been a big deal in the house. And I listen to hip hop. And so when she, at bath and bedtime, I don't listen to music that she wants to listen to. We're all trying to unwind. So Dad picks the music. So I go to YouTube and it's Queen Latifah and Tribe Called Quest. And
sure.
The radio edits of all the popular 90s and early 2000s hip hop. So she knows all these guys by voice and everything. So oftentimes she'll just ask me to play some music. So it could be anything at any given time. It could be not just Bob Marley, but it could be Steven or Ziggy or any one of them.
How do you think you're going to deal with it when she becomes 13 and specifically buys music just to piss you off? Like, for example, when I was 11, 12, it was prime grunge. Like, that's when Nirvana, everything, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I liked it because kids liked it and we were all drawn to that angst and that grindy guitar, right? Chris Cornell's voice is like, yes, I'm 12. I hate everything.
Right.
But so I remember playing that stuff extra loud in the house just to kind of irk my parents. Like, how are you going to deal with that? Like, because you know you did it too. Like, how are you going to deal with that?
Well, for starters, because my parents were big music fans, and my parents had—I mean, they didn't like, you know, curse at me or in front of me, but my parents were—they were free with the lip or whatever. Sure. There weren't things that could shock me, or my parents, like, I memorized whole Richard Pryor albums by the time I was 9 or 10 years old.
Right on.
So, Richard Pryor on your wall, awesome.
Oh yeah, you see him.
So you can't really shock me, and also, again, I've taken my child to poetry slams literally from the womb. Her first Mental Graffiti, she was not 2 months old.
Mm.
So she can't really do things like that to shock me. All, for me, it's all about content. What is it about the content that you dig? I mean, she actually has been on her first hip hop record and she can't even listen to it yet because it's Psalm 1 and Angel Davenport. They recorded under Rapper Chicks. They're now Big Silky. She drops the intro and it's basically their big FU anti everything EP.
Mm-hmm.
And the third word out of someone's mouth is fuck you. So it's like, as a parent, you're not going to be able to shock me. I was at 13, you know what the biggest record on earth was when I was 13? Darling Nikki.
Yeah. Yeah.
The PMRC was formed when I was 13. I had that record in, not just in our house, but in my collection. So good luck with that. You know, the biggest record in America when I was 17 was Straight out of Compton.
Right.
Knock yourself out.
Yeah, she's going to shock you by being like, this is this new country joint that's called I love the boots under the American flag or whatever.
Right. So, you know, do your worst. Do your worst.
I hesitate slightly to bring this up, but let's dive into poetry a little bit. I don't want to get too inside baseball and slam because that's no fun for anybody but the 9 people who are really into slam. But when did you stumble into it? So you know you were a vocalist, you were a musician, you were in bands and all that kind of stuff. You talked about writing at shows. At what point did it become crossing over from I'm a graph writer, I'm a fan of reading, writing, etc., into I'm going to start taking this on the road or start taking it to open mics and whatever?
Two things happened. The Roots' first couple of albums had Ursula Rucker on them.
Oh, word. Okay.
And I had been messing with poetry and I was like, oh, I can be on a hip hop record and not rapping. And I was a graph writer and I was a breaker when I was much younger. I was like, okay, I can talk about things or relative to what else is on this record and be invited. That happened simultaneously with either 93 or 94, back in the old days when the earth first cooled. A lot of people don't remember this. Lollapalooza was not a destination festival in Chicago.
Right.
Lollapalooza was a traveling carnival festival in amphitheaters across America. One year at Lollapalooza, at all stops, they had a tent that was curated by a bunch of slam poets.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Including, I believe, Shappy.
Mm-hmm.
I think Gary Glazner.
Mm-hmm.
It was a few cats, but I met Shappy and I met a few people who ended up being regulars at several open mics and the Uptown Poetry Slam. And I was like, this is cool. I can do this in short bursts of 2, 3, 4 minutes. I write lyrics. I've got bursts of this into, and like there's open mics for this. And that was 93, 94. So I had, around that time, I had already discovered the Heartland, but not the poetry open mic, the music open mic.
Yeah.
But I discovered the open mic at Estelle's. I discovered Full Moon Madness. I had found Lit X at Another Level in Wicker Park and some like.
Lit X was, I'm sorry to interrupt it. Tina Howell, is that Lit X?
Tina Howell and Mario Smith.
Yeah.
And I became a regular, Lit X became my first like regular venue where I read regularly. And like from the mid 90s on, I became an open mic rat. It was open.
Mm-hmm.
It was over. To this day, to this very day, I can count on one hand the number of times that I have been to an open mic or poetry slam and not been on the list.
Yep. Yep.
And one of those times, it was because I left myself off the list because I was DJing the show.
You're a performer. And we always knew that about you. And that was the thing. Like, Billy always goes up, you know, and that's kind of the... kind of the jam, you know, like you were, I hate to use the term elder statesman, but now that like you're now that we're all grown, I feel less offensive about it. But like you really were kind of the, you know, career uncle of a lot of baby slam poets for, you know, because a lot of us like started coming around when we were, you know, 19, 20, 21 years old and stuff. I think you and I met when I was 21 and you were already a more established dude. You didn't buck on like wild, dumb drama bullshit. Like you were definitely the more grown dude. Yeah.
Here's the thing. By the time you were becoming a regular, I was still relatively new. And what's different for me in the early 2000s versus like even the cats that came before me, and of course everybody who comes after me who comes up through Youth Slam and stuff like that, was I already had other avenues that I was putting poetry in.
Sure.
Because of like that whole Ursula Rucker thing and then Jessica Care Moore doing stuff on like Nas's record. I had been doing hip-hop shows. I had been on hip-hop records. I had already been in an independent film as a quote-unquote slam poet, and I hadn't won shit. Like, sure. I hadn't won a Grand Slam in Chicago. I hadn't been at anybody's regional or national. So it was like, oh, y'all do this nationally? Okay, I'll give it a spin. And then, of course, 15 years later.
Right, you know. Right.
But even at that point, like, By the time you and me were teammates, I had been, that was like my second or third team. Mm. I still was like, oh, this is really a thing.
Sure.
Okay. I felt like I was still getting my feet wet, but I had other places where I was doing this. So it still even wasn't a huge deal to me at that point.
Was it a conscious thing? Like, are you consciously, when you go to shows, because you go to shows frequently, and I know that we're in COVID, so shit's weird, but like, because you go to shows so frequently and you generally are the guy who's kind of the mainstay, like the ground wire, like, are you conscious about mentoring younger folk?
That's something that I got conscious about a little over 10 years ago when Koval and those guys made me a regular, a louder than a bomb.
Hmm.
That was a responsibility that I took regularly. Without going into any of YCA's negativity, all the things that they've gone through, even before that, I was not a full-time part of YCA. So I always felt like I'm an outside agent. I'm not beholden to all of their rules or whatever. So this was back in the days of MySpace, 2007, 2008, kids would get in touch with me about stuff.
Sure.
So I'd be like, yeah, okay, under the wing. So it became a conscious thing around the time that we shot the documentary. Once the documentary got shot and I understood that people were looking at me, also being mentored by a lot of hip hop and poetry figures at that point, and being in my late 30s and understanding what that meant, that became a conscious thing a while ago. Like, even before people started using the L word, legend, or calling me an elder statesman. And even before I was like, that was 2008, 2009. I was part of Polyrhythmic for a few years, but I wasn't even regularly hosting my own stuff at that point. I had started taking that thing seriously, and I think that was one of the things that I built on when I became a regular part of N1 Ear or forming Four Star Poets.
So, like, you've done a bunch, I mean, all that stuff that you've done, you know, forming Four Star, being on teams, being a graph writer. I mean, all the stuff that you've done, like, did you feel, at least in your development, any sort of tug from one to the other? Like, myself, I've been, there was a conscious moment, I think, in like 2004, where I decided I'm not going to focus on music anymore and I'm going to focus on poetry. And this is the thing that I'm doing now. And it wasn't like, you know, fuck music forever, but it was definitely, I felt like I was serving one more than the others. Is that something you've ever felt?
I think that within the context of those crafts, yes. Within the context of the things that I could do that I was capable of, no, because I knew that at one point, music to me, I could only take it as seriously as people around me. I was lucky enough, even after I put down trying to be in a band, to end up in a couple of music situations where I could record, be a background vocalist, be a co-lead vocalist, and just kind of scratch the itch. For me, once I got involved in performance poetry, it became a matter of how involved did I get in one aspect or another. The irony of forming Chicago Four Star Poets was not to just slam any given time, but to also be available as, oh, here's this group of four or five poets who can also run workshops, facilitate, sure, and do all of the other things that Slam is the gateway to. Just like Mark Smith's trick was to, like, give out scorecards to pay attention. Okay, now we've come to compete to get you to pay attention. You know, we love the game, but you don't have to be dicks about it. Don't take this ass whooping personal. It's all fun and games. It's the funny thing that you asked me, that the irony of, it was like, when I first formed Four Star, you were one of the people that I pulled aside with the idea. And then at the time, you were like, I think it's a great idea to not have to rely on just Slam to form these teams. Like, go with who you want to. Mm-hmm. I just don't know that I'm ready to do that because I don't know how much time I'm going to put into that. And I thought to myself, yeah, I don't know either.
Yeah.
Fast forward a year later, me and Andy Calthrufos, we decided that we were going to do this. And the irony of it is that the people who were around, say, your age or older, were the ones who were all in more or less transition, while it was the ones who were younger, except for, like, Rick, that were all like, yeah, let's do it. Fast forward 10 years, a lot of poets that are still regular in Slam, as Slam has kind of disintegrated from, we all have to compete for this big national competition, to let's form our own teams and go, it actually has gone in that direction.
Yeah.
Whether or not it took the cataclysm of nationals collapsing to do that, it's actually gone in the direction of, I would rather work with these four or five people.
Yeah.
And so the four or five people that I work with regularly, they're all, like, super tight sibling, homies, niece, nephew types, mm-hmm, that we all write together and work together anyway. And we still do the competition thing. Like, even 10 years of Four Star did not stop me from being on six or seven more middle, sure, graffiti or people poetry slam teams.
Sure. Yeah, so, I mean, the team, people forming their own teams was an important thing. Like, I've told this story on the show before, but we had this issue where they did Rust Belt in Toronto, and they're like, we need to get these teams. There aren't enough teams to go up there. So yeah. Detroit called me. So Jamal May, Tom Budde, and Kerry Warrella called me, and we're just like, hey, you want to do it? You want to represent Detroit? And I was like, no, absolutely not. Under no circumstances will I represent Detroit. And they're like, all right, well, we don't have to call it Detroit. You could be like, it's a scratch team. And I'm like, okay, let's just do that shit. So then we did it, and then Flesh and Blood came around, and then Four Star jumped in. So it was like, we, you know, those were the first teams at Rust Belt that were, yeah, that were straw teams. And now they're, like, it was all straw teams. Like, it's all best of the best.
I was asked to hop on Minneapolis that year, and Heather, a.k.a. Heather, waited literally 7 days too late. I had called, because that was the year me and Candy got married. I had called the ball on it. I'm like, we're not sending a team. Nobody's got a pickup for me, so I guess I'm not going.
Yeah.
A week later, Heather was like, you want to slam in Toronto? I'm like, no. Yeah. Yes, but no. But yeah.
That was a wild one, and it definitely felt like things were going to get different. It felt different from then on, because no one, it wasn't like, all right, this is before, like, just for context for listeners, the Rust Belt Regional Slam was always about 2 months before Nationals. And it was kind of like where your team did its first scrimmages. It's like where you showed up and you saw, like, all right, how do these pieces work? How do these things stack up against teams that aren't the same people that we perform against or compete against every single week? And how are things a little bit different? So it was always teams. And then at some point, like, we all just kind of went, I don't think there's any rules that it has to be a nationally certified team. So we just started grabbing our own stuff. I definitely felt a shift there where the poetry became more about the poets showing off for each other as opposed to the poets trying to get their team prepped for Nationals. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. And the other regionals, like Southern Fried and Redwood, they still do it the same way, in the old-fashioned way. And that's great, too, because the year that we won, what the cool thing was is, like, you know, we created a buzz. 2 years after we won, I came in second at Rust Belt with that team.
Yeah.
And we created a buzz. So then you kind of have people looking out, ooh, you know, Middle Graffiti is coming with that shit.
Yeah.
But the other side of it is that when you go with your friends, even if you're going to Nationals and it's a couple of people, it's still a little bit more relaxed. Even if you're going to compete, it's a little bit more relaxed.
Yeah, and that's the thing that that people haven't talked about a lot is that when you had a team, and granted, you know, Nationals are no longer currently not a thing. But when you had a team, a lot of times you kind of got shoehorned together. Like, you'd get these folks that didn't necessarily write together, weren't necessarily the people that you would have chosen to work with in some situations, and you kind of do whatever you can to put it together. You and I were on a couple teams like that with some folks where I was like, this is interesting. I learned a lot working with a certain human being that I could not stand when we first got on a team together. And then we ended up not being friends in the long term. But in that year and a half or so together that we were working closely, I definitely learned a lot. Like, it definitely shifted.
Yeah.
But it was a hell of a lot more fun going to Rust Belts with a whole bunch of people that I loved hanging out with.
Definitely.
And, yeah.
But I mean, like, even with that guy, you learned how to do the higher power thing that a lot of other people do. Probably my all-time favorite team is the 2010 team in Minneapolis. And what was cool about that team was you were on the Uptown team that year.
Yeah, I was on the Uptown team, yeah.
And that was a monster squad.
Right.
Our team at Middle Graffiti with Marty and Andy and Emily and John Paul, we were no game either.
Oh, yeah.
But they were looking for y'all to be like, here comes Chicago.
Right.
And then we kind of snuck in there like, oh, shit. And then it was like, what was cool was to see, like, the wide respect that we as a city and a scene got back. Even Palatine came with a bunch of 18-year-olds that were hot. Like, everybody, we came with a good dozen poets that were just like, oh, yeah, we kind of forgot about Chicago after about 3 or 4 years. And so that was fun. But like that year, we didn't do Rust Belt. We ended up at Marty's house doing like a bunch of actor exercises and approaching it a really different way. It was the same kind of high powered way that, you know, they do in New York and Austin and Charlotte and stuff. But it was a little different approach that kind of got noticed and it kind of changed the approach. That's why, like, I've always enjoyed being a performance poet and using open mics and slam as a lab, as opposed to kind of falling into it and stumbling into it the way a lot of other people have, because it really is fronting a band of one.
Yeah.
Sometimes fronting a band of three or four. You end up there with your mates, but usually for 3 minutes, you got 3 minutes to go up there and be fucking Chris Cornell, to be Corey Glover, to be Robert Plant, any of them dudes you grew up loving, you got 3 minutes to do it. And that's what I've always enjoyed about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. You know, I mean, I came around at a bit of a weird time, because when I first started coming around, it was when Marlon Escara and Dennis Kim, Eitan Kadosh, Lucy, all those folks had just migrated away from the scene. So like, this was right when Sully took over Metal Graffiti. Urban Sandbox was still happening. So it was like this very odd, weird transition. And I just showed up like, hey guys, I'm excited about poetry. Do you love poems? there was a weird thing, but there was definitely some, some odd push pull. I think Sully at the time wrote the line, like, we push each other out of the sandbox in Chicago. And that was just a thing that I went, yeah, that is, it seems kind of true. The reason I'm getting to this is that, you know, you were there, you've been there for a long time and you're still standing. Like, you're still in the scene. You're still hosting people. You're still, you know, mentoring and et cetera. You always seem to be the guy who was just above any kind of bullshit, or didn't get bothered by interpersonal bullshit. Like, you got along with everybody. I hate to use like the Ferris Bueller example, but you were kind of had that sort of thing. Like, everyone was cool with Billy and Billy's just above it all. What was the secret to that? Because there's been some serious bullshit and drama around you, and you've never gotten sucked into it, that I could see.
The start of it is I take people at face value, which you learn is both good and bad. It's 80% good. The 20% bad comes when you've taken people at face value, and then they turn out to be not great people.
Sure.
But you find that out after the fact. Whether it's 5 minutes, 5 years, you find that out after the fact. I take people even as creatives because we're all out here and we're all learning. The strange part about when you came in and when I was starting to get my feet wet is that I was considered part of the end of the last wave and the beginning of the first. Mm-hmm. So it was still incumbent for me to like be nice and be welcoming, especially when, as this new wave was coming, it was a lot of kids. It was a lot of late teenagers and early 20-somethings. But also, I observe. I take people for what they are and what they present. And the people who I get to know socially, the people who I bring into my house, not just for slam team practices, but for birthday parties, people who, you know, call you up when you're going sure. through some drama and stuff like that, people just turn out to be people. And that's just my own personal nature. I'm a cynic about humanity at large, but I'm not a cynic about individuals. You show me who you are, and people generally have to look you in the face and not bullshit you. And that's really pretty much what it is. A lot of people take other folks' art and they have them draw that attitude with them. We're all either better or worse artists and presenters than the last person. So I don't let that cloud it. You're either going to get better at it or you're going to be a great supporter of the rest of us. There's a lot of in between, and I'm willing to examine that in between. But the flip side of it is I'm not really here for the bullshit. For as many people as I have welcomed or been welcoming to, from as many people that I have been willing to be mentored by or have mentored, I have gotten in folks' ears and told them to step off.
Sure.
We've had some crappy open micers in one ear over the years that I have made it subtly clear to them that they're not welcome anymore. I've made it very openly clear to them that, you know, I can't stop you from coming, but you're also going to have to deal with me. I'm not. And I tell people this, and you understand this when you understand my background as a Chicagoan, as a Black male, as a hip hop kid. This art shit is not all genteel. We don't all come from a soft, spongy place.
Right,
we're
right.
going to talk it out. And at some point, there's not going to be any words. I've had lots of conversations with people about bad things. Short story long, 2016 Nationals in Atlanta. A young man put his hands on a young lady, and while I did not see it, I witnessed it, and mm-hmm. several other poets witnessed it. And so late night in front of the hotel in Decatur, Atlanta, or Decatur, Georgia, I pulled the young man aside with three of my friends. Now, if you know me, you know I'm about 5'10" and built like a mop.
Right.
Okay. I'm Captain Skinny Dude. I can scrap. I'm from the city and all that,
right.
but I don't even like to go there. My guys surrounding me were probably three of the biggest, brawniest poets on the scene, nationally known. So I'm not going to put their names out there, but they also are some pretty peaceful cats. The young man decided at some point he did not like my line of questioning and was going to get sideways with me. And I had to stand up and get in his face. And then it's the three big dudes who had to be like, "Billy, pull out." Because you still signed the thing and the blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So my demeanor can go in any direction. And it's not a secret that if we have to go there, I can go there. I don't like to go there. And most people aren't here within performance poetry or any art scene. We're not here for that.
Right.
We're here for the solace and the serenity. And I'm all for that. And I'm here to facilitate that. And let's have some fun doing it, because quite frankly, even you know, 1995, 2005, whatever, there was still bad shit going on in the world then. It just hit us differently than it did over the last 4 years, 5 years, 5 months or whatever. So you just be welcoming and so treat people like you want to be treated.
Yeah, I mean,
the don't be afraid to call an asshole either.
Absolutely. I mean, we both come out of, you know, obviously we're you and I are a little bit older, you're older than I am, but like we definitely came from an era pre-social media, like talk shit, get hit was just kind of how it was, you know, like you couldn't talk shit and not get slapped in the mouth. Like if you talk shit, it came back to you, which is how it was. Now,
even figuratively,
absolutely. It always came back to you. And now, like with the internet, especially in high drama circles, like with a lot of poets, with a lot of feelings and stuff, you know, we've seen all kinds of drama blow up on the internet. And people talking all kinds of trash and everything. And I just go like, have none of you ever been slapped in the mouth before? Like, it blows my mind, the stuff that people say to each other online as if they don't know that these are real human beings.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a whole generation of, you know, you don't like to talk about it, but we come from the generation of just getting hit by a parent or a grandparent.
Sure. Sure.
Let alone saying some reckless shit out in the street.
Sure.
So, yeah. You're gonna, if I have to pull you aside and talk to you, then it's a problem. But it's 80% of the time, it's not a problem.
You continue to hang in there as the shows develop. I want to touch real briefly on In One Ear, because you weren't the host when I first started there. That was the first place I performed in the city. First place I played music, and the first place I performed as a poet, and the first place I ever featured. Like, the In One Ear is very important to me in the grand scheme of things. How has that show changed for you over time?
Well, being there from the No Exit days before Pete Wolf, the O'Toole days, in those earliest days, that was when I was just becoming an open mic rat. I was just a face to my rediscovery of In One Ear, just as I was becoming a face locally. What that and I became a both a regular and then a co-host of the show even before Polyrhythmic put its show down, and after Mental Graffiti, like I had stepped off of Mental Graffiti as a show host. I've always been a regular. Just keeping the city open to facilitation of performance art. Because In One Ear, it started out as a poetry open mic, but when Pete took it over, he opened it up to musicians and comedy and actors and things like that. So being a performance poet, it takes away from just having to listen to poetry all night long. Everything is going to change up. The pace is going to change up because people need help with setting up instruments or sound or other things. The attitude of there's always something different happening. So doing In One Ear, being stable in a great venue for a long time, and then having the venue instability to keep you on your toes, it's made it fresh. It's made it so that I'm still willing to do it at almost 50 years old. Oh, and on a weekly basis. If it weren't for the pandemic, we would still be every Wednesday or every Friday night, depending on the venue. And, you know, the worst times I have is when I don't feel like I have any energy to hop on the train to go do it. And by the time I get there and we're setting up, you know, there's a little bit of adrenaline and you feel good to do it. So it's still cathartic for me. What's changed is really just the people. At this point, there's a generation of artist performers that are, by my own metric of my parents and myself, that are young enough to be my kid, many of them amazing, some of them amazing because I had something to do with, which that's gratifying.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of them I had absolutely nothing to do with, but they managed to find our show, which is also gratifying. But also the show has, you know, that the show has done what it's supposed to do when you get featured in the newspaper, when magazines come to do an online feature about you. You know, you're doing the right thing. And the best part is that though I'm Slam connected, the show is not directly involved in Slam. Though we get tons of musicians, we're not directly connected to the musicians open mic scene, which has had its issues with, I don't know about organizers, but I know it's had its issues with some prima donna performers, and they've showed up
in 1 year.
And we've had to tell them, nah, dude, you get 7 minutes here, and tonight you're getting 7 minutes because you don't get five. So, you know, for all of the drawbacks, everything on top of those drawbacks are what make it worth it. And then you end up meeting great people. And when I say great people, people who go on to do great things just, you know, happen to be there. Everything from, you know, we talk about our local legends and names, which, you know, we always talk about you,
but
also Well, I mean, you know, you've done some stuff, and I've been alongside, so I make sure that I tell people you've done some shit.
Thank you, man.
But also, the random trivia that Crystal Bowersox was second at American Idol, she was a server at Heartland, and therefore a semi-regular in 1 year.
Oh, yeah. You know,
Hannibal Buress did Weeds. He did Safe Smiles with Polyrhythmic, and he did, you know, in 1 year. So you never know who's going to all of a sudden blow up, just be a writer or, you know, just do a thing. Be nice to people because they are going to be nice to you afterwards. And even, you know, that cool kind of mid-level fame, like somebody like Joe Hernandez-Kolsky.
Sure.
Just cool people who end up doing cool shit. And they will remember you, and people will come back and they'll be like, oh, wow, I learned about your show, and I'm here at 6 a.m. in India, and you're doing your thing. Like, welcome. All of it.
How do you survive? Because, I mean, there are certainly, we've all been to some open mics that are really good. In 1 year, in my experiences, has kind of ebbed and flowed like most shows do in terms of quality and what scene you're pulling. There are definitely those nights, though, as a host, and you've been there where, man, everybody is trying your patience and you are not feeling inspired by anything that's happening on the stage that night. Some nights are just like that. How do you survive that? And how do you keep going?
Gauge the rest of the crowd. Because if you know the rest of the crowd's not feeling it, then you can make jokes about it.
Right.
Always be prepared to punch up. Some of that I get from you. You have that really dry, wry,
thank you,
y'all are fucking with me sense of humor. And so I'm going to let you know. But also, it's my, if anybody buys into that Zodiac shit, it's my Aquarius nature. again, you let things roll off your back, especially when your show is a weekly. You know it's not going to be as dull or as bland or as whatever the next week. If it's individuals and they're coming at you, get the rest of the crowd on your side. But also, if you are one who imbibes, there's alcohol.
Yep, yep.
You know, and I'm in Illinois. I live in a legal state. There's weed now, too. So
yep, yep. God bless you.
There's just a matter of, for good or bad, find ways to take yourself out of the show. The best part is when you have an ensemble of organizers. Some night, you're not the A guy, so you can sit in the back.
Right.
You can do things like when it is your turn to spell the A host, or whatever, heckle from the back, do things, but keep the rest of the crowd on your side, right, or turn the entire crowd against you. Just don't have the crowd against each other. And even the people who are up there, even if they hated them, don't even have the crowd against them, because that person's got to go sit back down. Turn the whole crowd against you. Don't, you know, keep the crowd together. And it's really not that difficult.
Those are actually really, really, really good points. Unfortunately, we gotta wrap up a little bit. So I'm gonna ask you the last question I ask everybody, when I've got performers on. What is the worst show you ever did? And it could be a single show, it could be one night, it could be a thing you hosted, anything that comes to mind, or two, or whatever. Just worst show you ever did.
Literally, the worst show I ever did was late last year, early this year. The pandemic has got my time frame thrown off.
Mm-hmm.
In 1 year, when it's not a plague, a public health crisis, is at a music store called Flats and Sharps up in Rogers Park.
Mm.
We had an open mic regular who seemed to be kind of eclectic and out there, but an okay guy. As he's setting up for his set, being sarcastic, he gets into his set and then it starts into outright shit talk directed at the hosts. Pete Wolf was sick that night, so it was just myself and Sarah King. And also I believe Gregory Curry, rest in peace. I believe he was also there that night. And it turned into outright anti-host shit talk. And In 1 Ear usually breaks up its open mic, and we finished the open mic after the feature. We only had two people left, and I pulled the plug on the whole thing. I was like, you know what? Show's over. You're out of here. You're never coming back. X, Y, and Z, blah, 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 even blasted them on the internet.
Woo.
Come to find out that even like with the internet blast, a couple of local hosts were like, yeah, we featured him too, and it went south also. It happens. But that's the first time that I ever had to literally, I mean, it's not a secret, and I didn't have to put my hands on anybody, and I didn't violate my venue, which is not my space. But it's the first time that I had completely come out of pocket on my own.
Sure.
And that one only supersedes number two because I didn't have to come out of pocket. 2016 Nationals, once again, this was in Decatur, Georgia.
Uh-huh.
I was the host of Head to Head Haiku. A young lady decided to write a saucy erotic haiku about the host, me, which was A, inappropriate because my wife and child were there. B, my mom was also the judge.
Do you think she was doing it just to embarrass you, or like was it legit?
It was a little bit from column A, a little bit from column B. The young lady was new to head haiku, and she thought that was the way that it was done every time. She did not understand read the room at all. And it was not you introduced the judges, so it was not a secret that my mom was there. My mom was sitting right in front of her. Also, the way Team Tuggle gets down, it was no secret that my wife and kid were there. You know, you had this precocious four-year-old in the room. You know, we were all hanging out. Needless to say that got handled by the judges, and then it also got handled by some other friendly poets. So that took care of itself. I did not have to get sideways with anybody. So the one that happened at In One Ear within the last year, that one superseded that one because I thought that I was going to have to step outside on something.
Do you ever have those nights on the road where you're doing your set and you're contracted to do 20 minutes or 30 minutes or whatever it is? You get up there and you're 2.5 minutes in and you know this crowd is not fucking with me. Like, it's just not going to happen tonight. That used to happen to me because I was a little more confrontational than you, obviously. But like, is there a night in your mind that like that ever happened?
Only a couple times, and I don't remember them specifically. The ones that I remember specifically are a couple that where they start out with the feature, so you have not felt out the crowd other than maybe one or two opening poems. Or my very first tour on the East Coast, a nor'easter hit, and so everything got snowed over, and including the barista, there were 5-6 people in the room.
I've done those.
So I really had no idea what to do with that, except that I had seen poets like do, like, at that point, real readings where they just launched into it, no banter, and just dropped 3 poems on the room, like Saul or some of those cats. So I just did that. It was 20 minutes. I dropped 3 poems. Everybody was like, 5 people. They were like, woo! I dropped 3 more. My time was up. They were loving it. They were like, do 3 more. I did 3 more, and I sold everybody a book. So that one turned out to be great.
Sometimes they work out like that, man. Billy, it's been really good to catch up with you, dude. Do you have anything you want to plug?
In One Ear is every other Wednesday in a pandemic. We call it In One Ear Untethered. Find In One Ear Untethered on Facebook, and that is how you can join the open mic. Wednesday, I don't even have the calendar in front of me, but a week from this Wednesday, but it's every other Wednesday. Hit me up on facebook.com/thebackpackfiles or on Instagram, Backpack Files, for new poems, random shenanigans. I have a couple of chat books. They're $10 each. You can order them that way. One of them is super limited. It's my very first chat book, and I've got literally the last 20 copies of it. That's about it.
Cool.
Got published in some cool places like Knight's Library, so I'm supporting shit out of them.
Very cool.
Great Weather for Media, their anthology, Escape Wheel, get that. The Bored Friday Project by the Secret Society of Supervillain Artists. It's a visual arts journal that I've added some poems and shit to. That's available on Amazon. I don't make no money off none of that. Support these artists.
Yeah.
Support these artists. And that's really about it. Thank you very much, Baz. I love you to death. Support J.W. Bacillo and all of the things that he does, too.
Thanks, buddy. I appreciate you. It's really good to see you. Send my love to the family, and I will. Hopefully we'll connect really soon, man.
No doubt, brother. Be good to yourself.
All right, be good. See you.
Love you. Be good.
Love you.
Tell the truth and shame the devil.